So my name is Laurel O'Gorman, and I teach at Laurentian University. I have an interest in the history of Pride, the history of queer sexualities, but I'm not by any means an expert in this area. There are, I think, people in this room, actually, who know more about it than I do, however. I've done a lot of research on it, and what I want to do is facilitate a discussion, and if I can get a couple people thinking about things that they hadn't thought about previously, then I think I've done my job. If I use any language you don't understand, feel free to interrupt, ask for clarification about the language that I'm using, because I am used to presenting to university students, and I'm trying to gear it a little bit towards a wide range of educational backgrounds. And I really don't need to use any of this language, so please let me know if I do. So when I was asked to speak about this, one of the things I thought about is, like, the history of Pride. Where do you start? Like, how far back do you go? People who we would identify as queer LGBTQ people have existed throughout history. They've even found, like, cavemen representations on walls. So what's changed is our understanding, society's understanding of what same-sex attraction means or what gender means or how gender is supposed to be acted or represented. But if I'm talking about Pride, I thought it would be good to start with more recent organizing around gay rights or gay liberation. And so I thought about starting around the 1950s. Now at this time, there were groups that were homophile organizations and started with the Mattachine Society in 1950, although there are accounts of organizing before that. And at this time, homosexuality was seen to be a mental illness. It was illegal. You could be arrested for having same-sex sexual encounters or for dressing in a gender that didn't match with your genitalia as perceived by the police. So homophile organizations decided to start doing some organizing, and as you can see from the pictures, they were very appropriately dressed by the standards of that time. They didn't want to stand out. They wanted to say, look, we're just like you. We may have this mental illness, if that's what you want to call it, but we would like to participate in society just like straight people. And the signs say things like, you know, they want their right to make the maximum contribution to society, or homosexuals should be judged as individuals. Something happened around 1960. Now, around 1960 is a time where there was a civil rights movement that was starting to take hold. There was anti-war protesting. There was a lot of activism that was happening. And it changed the gay liberation movement. It was radicalized. It went from mental illness to please accept us even though we're not like you to, you know, fuck you, we're not like you, and that's okay, we're proud of who we are, right? Sorry. So there was an impact on the civil rights movement, black power, anti-war, feminist, student movements, all of these movements kind of worked together. And I actually have a video that I'd like to show. We're not entirely sure how well the speaker is going to work, so hopefully it works. The movie is called Before Stonewall. It was made in 1984, and it's going to talk about a little bit about the civil rights movement and the impact that it had.
And the civil rights movement of late 50s and the 60s was a prototype of every single liberation movement in this country that we are still dealing with.
The crowd occupies every inch on the lawns and under the trees, and there's a great swell of cheers to welcome Martin Luther King to the speaker's podium, a man who stands as a symbol of all they are fighting for.
I have a dream. One day, this nation will rise up, live out the true meaning of its creed.
African Americans said no more. They refused to hide behind the stereotypes that we were supposed to have. We said no good. No good. You know, then everybody got the feeling whatever the oppression was, well, maybe I won't have to take this either.
I think that the connections between black liberation, women's liberation, and gay liberation are very deep. Many of us who went south to work with Dr. King in the 60s were gay. I remember a plane going down from Chicago. There were six priests, and three of us were gay. A lot of gay people who could not come out for their own liberation could invest those same energies in the liberation of black people.
You need to begin with a movement, which is what Black Power and the Civil Rights Movement was. Then, immediately within it, you are going to get those people whose differences are not being articulated, which is, right, us. So then there is immediately another step.
In the 60s, there was a distinct change in the temper and the tempo of the gay movement, partly as a result of the Black Civil Rights Movement militancy. We began to get more militant in the gay movement. We began to see that the problem of homosexuality is not really gay people's problem. It's a problem of the social attitudes of the people around us. And we had to change their attitudes, and that in turn would help us with our self-image.
So that was just a little bit on that. The intersectionality of the fight for liberation and different movements working together. So the Stonewall Inn is a space where a major, major incident happened that transformed the way that we fought for gay liberation. And it was in Greenwich Village in New York, which it's a really interesting area to begin with. It was settled in the 1600s by freed Africans as well as Dutch. So it was an interracial neighborhood and an impoverished neighborhood for a long time. It's recently been gentrified, as has so many historical areas. It housed New York's first penitentiary. So it also had this really important bohemian culture in it and a kind of the start of a hippie culture in the 60s. It had safe houses for anti-war protest, anti-war activists. And it actually also had the first interracial nightclub in 1938 out of all of the United States. So there was a lot happening here as far as social activism goes. The Stonewall Inn was a bar in this neighborhood. It was owned by the mafia, because if you're in a situation where it's illegal to be gay, and it's illegal to sell alcohol to people who are gay because that would entice them to commit lewd acts, the mafia gets involved, right? Because they're like, I see money here. So the mafia actually would pay the police to not raid the bar, or to raid it not very often or at specific times, or, you know, just let us know when you're coming so we can tell our important people to leave. And there are reports that it was about $1,200 a month that the mafia was paying to the police to try and keep this establishment going. And it was a popular bar for poor and very marginalized queer people. It was frequented mostly by drag queens, trans people, homeless people, LGBT people of color. And the reason for that is the mafia also decided to blackmail people who went in, who were read as having enough money that they're like, oh, so I know you work for the government, so if you don't pay me, I'm going to out you, and then it'll destroy your whole life. So there were a lot of really interesting things around Stonewall. Now, there were police raids at this time at a lot of bars, and there was a script, and a social script is basically the same thing as a movie script where you read line by line, but it's in a social situation, and it's a way that things typically transpire. So the social script for police raids were, the police would enter the establishment. The men would all line up in one area, and each of them would be ID'd. Now, the police would write down their information. If you had a job in the public sector, you could lose your job. If you worked for a police force, if you worked for the government, you would lose your job because the government does not employ gay people. Your name and your home address, all of your personal information could go into the local newspaper. So all of your neighbors, your friends, your family would know that you're gay, and your life is then ruined. You can't practice law, you can't practice medicine, anything that needs a license, even a mechanic's license, an esthetician's license, you would lose your license or the ability to acquire one because you were once found in a gay club.
Sorry, what year was this?
This is 1969, where the event happened. So this is in the United States in the 1960s. So female police officers would take people who were dressed as women into a bathroom and actually check their genitals, either through sight or touch. They often gave the woman the choice. And if their genitals didn't match their physical appearance, they would then be arrested because it was against the law to dress in a gender that wasn't the one that the police or whoever was in charge said that your gender was. So there was this particular script that took place. So your clothing has to be approved by the police as being codified as okay for your gender. And most days, I know I wouldn't pass that test. So something changed on June 28th, 1969. The police raided the Stonewall Inn. And I'm going to show another clip from a movie called Stonewall Uprising. And this movie you can find on PBS Video. So it's available online, and it only works on Internet Explorer. So if you're trying to watch it, I hope you're not completely opposed to Internet Explorer like I am. But it's worth it. So I'll show it.
Going to happen later on, you know, was to make history.
I remember it being a clear evening with a big black sky and the biggest white moon I ever saw.
It was incredibly hot. You throw into that the Stonewall was raided the previous Tuesday night. So it was a perfect storm for the police. They didn't know what they were walking into.
Most raids by the New York City police, because they were paid off by the mob, took place on a weeknight. It took place early in the evening. The place would not be crowded. This was a highly unusual raid. Going in there in the middle of the night with a full crowd, the mafia hasn't been alerted, the Sixth Precinct hasn't been alerted.
We only had about six people all together from the police department. Knowing that you had a precinct right nearby that would send assistance.
We were in the back of the room. And the lights went on. So everybody stopped what they were doing. Because now the police started coming in, raiding the bar. They pushed everybody like to the back room and slowly asking for IDs. Meanwhile, there was crowds forming outside the Stonewall wanting to know what was going on.
We were talking about the revolution happening. And we're walking up 7th Avenue, and we were thinking that it was either Black Panthers or the Young Lords are going to start it. And we turn the corner from 7th Avenue onto Christopher Street, and saw a paddy wagon pull up there. And some people came out and being very dramatic, throwing their arms up in a V, you know, as a victory sign.
That night, I'm in my office. I looked down the street, and I could see the Stonewall sign, and I started to see some activity in front. So I run down there, and as I'm looking around to see what's going on, police cars, different things happening, it's getting bigger by the minute. And the people coming out weren't going along with it so easily.
A rather tough lesbian was busted in the bar, but when she came out of the bar, she was fighting the cops unless they tried to get away. And the harder she fought, the more the cops were beating her up, and the madder the crowd got. And I ran into Howard Smith on the street. The Village Voice was right there, and Howard said, boy, there's a riot going to happen here. And I said, yeah, and the police were showing up. And so Howard said, we've got police press passes upstairs. You know, Howard's concern was, and my concern was, if all hell broke loose, they'd just start busting heads. At least if you had press, maybe your head wouldn't get busted.
Things started off small, but there was an energy that began to flow through the crowd.
People were screaming, take copper. People started throwing pennies.
And then everybody started to throw pennies, like, you know, like they were, this is what they were, nothing but copper, you know, coppers. That's what they were worth.
So it was mostly Goofy, really, basically Goofy, like, getting in the car, rocking them back and forth, calling them names, telling them how good looking they were, grabbing their butts, doing things like that, you know, just making their lives miserable for once.
So the atmosphere, from what they've said, is there's two things going on, right? First, you've got this kind of party, joking, fun atmosphere where you're, you know, throwing coppers at the coppers and, you know, saying, first, you're being paid off by the mafia, so we're going to pay you off. And also, that's what they're saying the police are worth at that point. And there's rocket kick lines, like drag rocket kick lines, but there's also fire and riots and broken windows. So you've also got this scary kind of angry atmosphere both going on at the same time. And there was a quote that I've read about it. The police were trapped in the bar at one point, and they were scared. There was all these people outside who are very, very upset with them. And there was a quote saying, "We just wanted to make those police as scared that one night as I am every single day." So there's this really antagonistic relationship there, right? And if we look at the media, there's an actual article I clipped here that said, "Homo nest raided, queen bees are stinging mad." So it was acceptable to talk about queer people with these kinds of words, like in mainstream media. That's the type of respect and the type of environment that they were facing every day. And this is 1969. It's not that long ago, right? So it cleared up at about 4 a.m. And the second night, it wasn't just the regular people who frequented the Stonewall Inn that showed up for a second night of protests. It was actually very respectable queer people, gay men and lesbians with jobs who worked for the city, who had everything to lose, started showing up. People from the Black Panthers, people from the anti-war movement, from the feminist movement, all kinds of people started showing up and rallying together to support this LGBT liberation. And it turned into something that I'm going to show just one more clip. Let me just see. So this was a catalyst for what we now consider or know as the Pride Parade. So I'm going to show that clip of how that happened.
The riot could have been buried. It could have been a few days in the local newspaper, and that was that. But we had to follow up. We couldn't just let that be a blip that disappeared. And I hadn't had enough sleep, so I was in a somewhat feverish state. And I thought, we have to do something. I thought, we have to have a protest march of our own. And they were having a meeting at Town Hall. There were 400 guys who showed up, and I think a couple of women, talking about these riots, because everybody was really energized and upset and angry about it. And I raised my hand at one point and said, "Let's have a protest march." And Dick Leitch, who was the head of the Mattachine Society, said, "Who's in favor?" And I didn't see anything but a forest of hands.
The effect of the Stonewall riot was to change the direction of the gay movement. We were going to propose something that all groups could participate in. And what we ended up producing was what's now known as the Gay Pride March.
In those days, the idea of walking in daylight with a sign saying, "I'm a faggot," was horrendous. Nobody was ready to do that. So I got into the subway, and on the car was somebody I recognized, and he said, "I've never been so scared in my life." I said, "Well, please let there be more than 10 of us. Just please let there be more than 10 of us. Because it's all right in the village, but the minute we cross 14th Street, if there's only 10 of us, God knows what's going to happen to us."
We had no idea we were going to finish the march. We had no speakers planned for the rally in Central Park, where we had hoped to get to. We didn't expect we'd ever get to Central Park. We assembled on Christopher Street, at 6th Avenue to march.
And we were about 100, 120 people. And there were people lining the sidewalks ahead of us to watch us go by, gay people, mainly.
And we were going fast. People that were involved in it, like me, referred to it as the first run. We had been threatened bomb threats. We had been, you know, people could take shots at us. We were scared. But as we were going up 6th Avenue, it kept growing.
I looked back, and there were about 2,000 people behind us, and that's when I knew it had happened. I say I cannot tell this without tearing up. And Peter and I walked the rest of the whole thing with tears running down our face. But that's when we knew we were ourselves for the first time.
So after that, there was a parade every year that started the same route. Things have changed a little bit, but it's around the same time of year, and it commemorates this one event. Now, I want to talk a little bit about a gay liberation movement versus a gay rights movement. And I thought about putting up definitions, but they were so dry that I thought synonyms might give the same idea. So if we look at rights, rights are privileges, it's an advantage, authority, birthright, claim, deserving, due, liberty, even permission and power. Whereas if you look at liberation, the synonyms are freedom, deliverance, emancipation, setting free, deregulation, and unshackling. So there's a really important difference and distinction between movement for rights and a movement for liberation. So as far as rights go, the state, which state is a word I use to refer to any governing body over a specific geographical location, the state determines who is a citizen and who isn't a citizen, and then affords specific rights to citizens. So for instance, you get the right to free speech, or you get the right to practice a religion of your choosing, or from a certain set of religions you can pick from. Luckily in Canada, it's of your choosing. Or you have the right to get married to specific types of people under certain conditions. And then you expand on these rights to either include new rights, to understand the rights differently, or to include new people in these rights. At first, these rights were only afforded to white, straight men in this North American context. So as you can imagine, these rights, which are developed by straight, white, wealthy men, for straight, white, wealthy men, have certain reasons for existing. They have certain intentions behind them. And then we expand these rights, like, okay, now women can own property too, so we'll expand some of these rights to women. We'll expand them to people of color. We'll expand some of them under very limited conditions to Aboriginal people. Let's include sexuality as a reason to not be taken away from access to these rights. Gender identity and rights is something that's been coming up a lot in the news right now as an important issue. So what rights exist, and who do they exist for, and how is that decided? So we have to look at who doesn't have these rights. And people without documentation, like immigrants without the proper documentation, have very few rights or limited rights in what we're referring to as Canada. Sex workers don't have a lot of rights. People who have polyamorous relationships don't have the right to get married to whoever their partners may be. So these rights exclude a lot of people, but they exist for a specific reason. But they allow us to be free to marry the one person we choose to marry and live monogamously with that person in a specific social condition. And so there's a word that I teach that's called homonormativity, and I want to use that word today. But to explain it, we have to look at heteronormativity, which is the normative nature of heterosexuality within society. So society is set up in such a way that it assumes everybody's heterosexual, and that everybody is either male or female, and that how you express your gender will conform to what your genitals happen to look like. And those genitals will fit into one of two boxes, as either male or female. And people who are male will act masculine, and people who are female will act feminine. So it's basically what you see on TV every single night is heteronormativity. Whereas homonormativity is the idea that gay people can conform to this heteronormative idea and still live exactly the way straight people live. And we'll just expand some of the rights to also include same-sex marriage. And it creates a large group of people who just want to get married, have children, and consume. It's like the gay culture becomes a culture of consuming. And if you look at like Queer Eye for the Straight Guy type of TV shows, the gay culture is very immersed in this idea of consumption and the lesbian aesthetic, and you know, you need to buy your $150 Doc Marten boots, and it's very much immersed into this idea of consuming products. And so if we're using the language of liberation, you can see how a lot of these movements can work together to try and create some kind of change. But using a language of rights, that same type of change doesn't necessarily have to happen. So I would like to move to talk about intersectionality. This is a little bit problematic, but I like it anyway. So the triangle at the top is Bob. Bob is a stripy blue triangle, and he should be proud to be a stripy blue triangle. Sadly, some people do not like Bob. Bob faces oppression for being a triangle and for having stripes. And I don't know if you can read those little things up here, but the one group is holding signs saying, "Down with stripes," and the other one says, "God hates triangles." Luckily, there are liberation groups, but they aren't intersectional, so they look like this. And one group says, "Welcome triangles," the other one says, "Welcome stripes." But they don't like each other. In fact, they compete. And if you can see these little guys right here, the triangle's saying, "I'm more oppressed," and the stripy circle is saying, "No, I am. I deserve more." And so Bob can't work out where to go. Is he more stripe, or is Bob more a triangle? So Bob wishes that the triangles and stripes would work together. And intersectionality is the belief that all of these oppressions are interlinked and they need to be studied together. If we're talking to somebody who is an Aboriginal two-spirited person with a disability, and they need some help, well, what type of group do they access? What is their most oppressed feature? You can't understand their gender without understanding their sexuality, the history of colonization and how that's affected them as an Aboriginal person. You can't separate these out. So how does a person fight for gay rights without thinking about maybe their disability or the fact that they're female or the fact that they're a person of color or all of these other things that all work together to create various types of oppression? So if we're going to move to a Canadian context here, so Toronto's first Pride has a very similar story to Stonewall, and that was Operation Soap, which is the bathhouse raids. And it happened on February 5th, 1981, at 11 p.m. Four bathhouses were raided by police. 286 men were arrested. Unfortunately, I haven't found any movies about it, so I can't show any footage. But it seems very similar to what happened in Stonewall. Now, the following night, thousands of protesters took to the streets downtown. And on March 6th, they had a gay freedom rally, which included Reverend Brent Hawkes was on a hunger strike since the arrests to try and free the people or free the few that were still being charged for it and drop all of the charges. There was a member of parliament there. Margaret Atwood, the author, was there as well. And this is known as the first street incarnation of what we think of as Pride Week. Now, Pride has gone from this fight against these arrests to what we see today. So I took just a couple of photos about this corporate advertising that we see at Pride. I watched the parade this year, and when I was looking at it, it was kind of like, to me, it was a way for companies to be like, we support you in theory, right? Because there were so many little, what I saw as almost hypocrite moments. That on one hand, I'm very happy to see that companies are able to be supportive of gay rights. On the other hand, they're not always that supportive, despite being there. With a couple of examples. So we've got a couple of politicians in Canada who are out and gay, such as Wynne. But they have policies that oppress people who live in poverty. They have Justin Trudeau's immigration policies that he has discussed, which isn't a lot of them, would make things worse as opposed to better, in my opinion. So whereas it's nice to see them able to march in a parade, on the other hand, they also oppress a lot of people. This one here, I don't have anything good to say about. So the police were marching at Toronto Pride, and we've come so far as policing goes, from what you saw at the Bath raids and at Stonewall to a time when police can march in the parade and police can be out and open. And there's something really positive to be said about that. And actually, just 10 years ago, if you went to the Pride parade, the police were not really happy to be there. They were kind of just standing there begrudgingly. You could tell they wanted to be at home, whereas now they're marching and smiling and wearing rainbows, and it's a very big difference. And we might think about it and say, okay, well, Stonewall happened in 1969. That wouldn't happen now. But actually, in the 21st century, so in the year 2000, there were bathhouse raids on a woman's bathhouse in Toronto called the Pussy Palace. And there was a possible liquor license violation. So they had 6 armed male police officers go in for a liquor license potential issue and walk around a women's clothing optional event for an hour looking through peepholes. There was a lot of controversy around this afterwards. And at the time, they decided to set up a liaison type of committee for the queer community. Guess how many out police officers there were on the force in the year 2000 in a city the size of Toronto when they tried to set up this committee? There was 1 out female police officer, and she was the one that was selected to head this group. And if we look at G20 and the arrests that happened at the G20, there are reports that queer and trans people were harassed by police. And there was even one report about, like, threatened rapes or something pretty serious that I haven't seen in the media or anything like that. But I think that the police being there shows how far we've come. But can we just see this without questioning where we've come from and how the police relations have come to be what they are now and what it means so far as the rights versus liberation? We're talking about the Olympics, and, you know, Olympians and athletes can now be out and gay and march in parades, and that's fantastic. On the other hand, what Olympics exists for trans people, and why is that not questioned at things like Pride? And then Russia is hosting the next Olympics. It's illegal to be gay in Russia. About 3 weeks ago, they expanded this law to foreigners. So if he goes to the Olympics, wins a medal, kisses his partner, well, now he's in jail for 2 weeks. If he has a flag on his backpack, he can be arrested. So there's some big problems there that kind of glossed over. And there's issues with funding, and this is QIA, Queers Against Israeli Apartheid. And they were told that if QIA was allowed to march at the parade, then Pride funding would be pulled, which is a huge problem. So this picture was taken from Stonewall, Toronto, which was a march to, it was a march against the corporatization of Pride, and it was an attempt to take back Pride from the companies. And I find the Dyke March kind of does the same thing. I was going to show more videos, but I think it'll just take too much time. But if you actually watch the Dyke March, there's a lot of politics involved. There's a lot of people holding signs that talk about things like suicide rates for queer youth, that talk about 30% of queer people are out to their doctors. Like, that's 70% of people who feel they can't be out to their doctors. And they talk about, like, if you look at the video from Extra, which is an actual legitimate news source, you've got some very, very sweet old lady yelling, "Fuck you, Stephen Harper." And so, I mean, you don't see that in Pride news coverage. There was also a quote from Sasha Bonbon, who said, "When you come to rely on funding from unreliable sources that don't necessarily have the best interests of our community at stake, then we come to rely on funding that we cannot control in the end." So there are other people telling us what we're allowed to do at Pride, what stories we're allowed to tell, what we're allowed to show, what's going to be there and what isn't. The other thing was with the Trans March this year. It's advertised as the first year the Trans March is going to be, like, what was the word they use, authorized, or, you know, it's going to be like the legitimate Trans March. But why does that mean that it's the first time the police are going to be escorting trans people down the streets? Why can't they have, you know, an actual trans march without necessarily needing the police escort? So I found that to be a little bit of an issue. And apparently this year, Toronto Pride had the largest trans march ever in, I think it's the world, the most people marching, most trans people marching, and that's not in the news. Why isn't it in the news? What would that tell, you know, the little 10-year-old girl in Timmins who's trans and needs to see that there is a community out there, and she can't see it because it's not being reported? So if we're getting into a Sudbury context, we didn't have a huge type of riot leading to Pride, unfortunately, because that would probably be a great story to tell. But on July 19th, 1997, we had our first Pride, and it wasn't just an organizing from people within the queer community. There were other people as well. And I feel like the story of Mary Ross was a bit of a catalyst, and it was a woman that lost her job because she was gay, and there was a lot of activity around trying to support her with that. The Sudbury Coalition Against Poverty organized around the Mike Harris era Days of Resistance, and there was a Justice with Dignity campaign, which was about how social policies can continue to create poverty and actually imprison people, and it was against a fraud policy that actually had a woman who was 8 months pregnant. Her name was Kimberly Rogers, and she died, and so it was organized around that. The Sexual Assault Crisis Center was involved, and it always has been. Access AIDS has always been involved. So there was a lot of other things going on to organize Sudbury's first Pride Parade. Now, they were expecting 60 people, and they had 300 show up. So I think the big question that I want people to think about is, where do we want to go from here? Are we happy with this discourse about rights? Are we happy with where things are heading? Are we okay with having corporate sponsors come in and give us money and have the corporate logos on our pamphlets and have politicians and whatnot participating in these events? Do we want to just think about the rights that we have, the rights that we want, and try and expand them so other people, such as trans people, poly people, people in other nations can start to have access to these rights? Or do we want to think about really fundamentally changing the way things are socially organized so that we actually have a movement that fights for the liberation of all people against all forms of oppression? And it's not for me to decide or to tell you that we have to liberate everyone. That's clearly where I'm coming from. But I want people to have this information and to think about where Pride came from, the people that fought before us to get where we are now. What did they want? Why did they go through all of the stuff that they went through, and how can we honor that in future Prides? what do we want Pride to look like in the future, and what could it look like if we don't do anything to stop it? Will it just be a bunch of McDonald's banners, and the rainbows will disappear, and it'll all be McDonald's? But I also want us to remember that from Stonewall right until current Pride, it's a party, but it's also a fight. So if you lose the party aspect of it, then people won't want to come. It'll be boring. They'll get burnt out from all of the organizing. But if you lose the fight, then nothing is ever going to change, and we'll actually go back. Things will get worse if we stop fighting for better. So I think it's important that we keep both of those aspects as part of Pride. And yeah, that's all I have to say.